Last week we looked at the introduction, suggested this, to the whole of the Deuteronomic work, including the book of Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic so-called history, books of Kings and Samuel and so on, and that beautiful chapter 4, which sums up really the essence of the book of Deuteronomy. Today we move to the second part of this book, which is from the last part of chapter 4 through to chapter 11, and we'll do a bit of it today and the rest of it next week, this section here. And it's about exclusive allegiance to Yahweh, to the Lord. And the first part is an introduction and the Decalogue. Before having Moses communicate to the people the rest of the statutes and edicts revealed to him at Horeb, which is really the main, in a sense, that's the purpose of this book. But before doing that, that starts in chapter 12, 2 weeks' time. The Deuteronomists offer what Walter Brueggemann calls, quote, the richest instructional, homiletical and theological materials in the book of Deuteronomy. For they, the chapters we're going to do this morning and next week, they articulate the historical memories and motivations that frame and give context to the commandments, statutes, ordinances that follow. Moses reminds the people, in this section we're doing today, of the, quote, covenant which Yahweh our God made with us at Horeb. Horeb, wilderness mountain, called by the priestly people Sinai. And he spells out, I'm not calling them the Ten Commandments, because the Bible doesn't call them the Ten Commandments. They call them the Ten Words. So I'll stay with that. And the English word, that's really a Greek word, deca is ten, logos is word, decalog in English is a good, even though a bit technical word, for the ten words which they heard spoken to them by Yahweh on the mountain. They must observe these words. These have a very, very special place in the whole of the Torah. They must observe these words, teach them to their children, and give exclusive allegiance to the God who revealed himself to Moses in the burning bush and led them out of Egypt and has brought them into the, now as they look into the promised land, Moses on Mount Nebo, look, he's brought us here, though Moses himself won't enter it. Deuteronomy 4 reads, verses 44 to 45, this is the law, Torah. Now, as I said last week, it's quite important for an analysis of the book of Deuteronomy. Torah in the book of Deuteronomy covers the whole of God's revelation, everything that God reveals, God's actions, God's words, God's presence, God's telling us what we're supposed to do in response, and so on. So this is the Torah, the law, that Moses set before the Israelites. These are, and I keep using the same translation for all these Hebrew words right through. A lot of the translations don't, but I don't think that's very helpful. So, to be technical, these are the decrees. The Hebrew is edut, if you want it. And the nuance of that word edut is a witness to the legislator's will. Edut, it means witness. So these particular group of, calling them decrees, arbitrary translation in a way, but these are the ones that witness to the will of God. Statutes, hukim is the Hebrew, and that means something that's written down, etched into stone somewhere, or kind of put in writing. And edicts, now an edict, that is a mishpatim, they're court decisions that are handed down from the magistrate or the lawgiver verbally and become common law, would that be a good way of putting it? So I'm not interested in all the absolute distinctions, but why these words are being used is they're different nuances looking at all the different ways in which God's will is pronounced, indicated in the Torah. That Moses spoke to the Israelites when they came out of Egypt beyond the Jordan. So he spoke them beyond the Jordan. So Moses is going to give us a lot more than the 10 words. And we'll do that in 2 weeks' time. Today we're going to focus on the 10 words that God gave on Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. Chapter 5. Moses convened all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the edicts that I'm addressing to you today. You shall learn them and observe them diligently." He won't give them till chapter 12, but this is the preparation. "Yahweh our God made a covenant with us at Horeb." Covenant, berit, and the word for made is cut a covenant. Literally, cut the covenant. "Not with our ancestors did Yahweh make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today." That's actually quite important, because he's speaking to the next generation. See, all the ones have died that were at Sinai in the story. Moses is now speaking to Joshua, one of the ones that was there, but he's the only one besides Caleb. And the rest of them are all their children, the next generation coming up who are going to enter. So he says, look, it wasn't for them that God spoke, it was for us. Now, when you read that document and you're in exile in Babylon, us means us. When you read it today in the church, it means us. It's for us. "Yahweh spoke with you face to face on the mountain out of the fire." There's the introduction, and the rest of today will be on the 10 words, which you're very familiar with, but I hope talking about them can enrich them for you. The Decalogue, the 10 words, are from Deuteronomy chapter 5 to chapter 5, verse 6 to 21. The text is clear that there are 10 words. It's not clear, however, on exactly how the words are to be numbered. And I'm stressing this for you because in many Protestant Bibles, for example, you'll see they're numbered differently to what you're used to in your Catholic Bible, the traditional. So if you say the fifth commandment, you'll get two different opinions as to which is the fifth. So the numbering is a little bit obscure. Now I'm giving you the background and why I've chosen to do what I'm doing with you. Since the time of Clement of Alexandria, who died in Alexandria, obviously, in 215 AD, verses 7 to 10 have traditionally been considered to make up the first word. That's what I'll be doing with you. And that's what you learnt in your catechism. That's the Catholic, ancient Catholic, and Orthodox, by the way, tradition. The conventional Jewish tradition is also to count these verses as one word, though they see them as the second word, not the first. Bit complicated this, but I'll try and... So verses 7 to 10, thank you, is one unit in Clement of Alexandria. It's also one unit in the Jewish tradition, though there are varieties there, but in the traditional Jewish... So it's a good reason to keep them together. The Jews, the first word is the statement of faith, that's verse 6. They call that the first word. It's not actually one of the commandments. So then the next one becomes the second and goes right through to the 10. We'll follow both these conventions by keeping verses 7 to 10 together, and we'll number them as the first word. This necessitates dividing verse 21 into two words, the 9th and the 10th. And that's complex, really, because one sentence gets shoved into two. Let's begin. The first word, I'll do the first and second now before the break. "I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." Jewish tradition has that as the first word. Then they'll go on in the next passage here to call this the second word. We, Clement of Alexandria and the Catholic tradition, has always been to consider all of this as the first word. And here it is. You shall have no other gods before me. Can you see there's an assumption underlying that, that there are other gods? We're not into monotheism yet. There are little beginnings of it in the exile, the shock of seeing the strange religions of Babylon. You'll see little pointers to it, but strict monotheism is only emerging at this time. They still presume that there are spiritual powers that are on the side of the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians, and so there are many gods, but you won't worship them. You'll only worship our God. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that's in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God. I want your love, commitment for me equals jealous. Zealous is another translation. Wanting what's best for us doesn't want us to spend our life getting distracted. I am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of their parents to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. Already quite a beautiful image of God. Look at it. Realistically, this is a matter of experience, isn't it? God punishes, that's their view. We would have perhaps a different way of looking at it. But in other words, if I do something wrong, it's going to affect my children and my children's children to the third and fourth generation. You can't avoid it. If I've mucked up, well, then my kids have had very bad parenting from me. They end up being pretty ineffective parents, you know, and that affects their kids, do you know what I mean? But it only goes for three or four generations, then it kind of, the river cleans. So talk about that as God's punishment, or talk about it as the effects of sin. But look at this. I show steadfast love to thousandth generations. Thousands is their biggest number. So, who love me and keep my commandments. Is it appropriate to draw the conclusion, if I do something sinful, wrong, it is going to affect you, of course, and it's going to affect, it'll be around for a while. It'll affect people within kind of living memory. If I do something good, it'll go on doing good forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. You never stop it. That's a very interesting thought. I think it's true, but it's also a beautiful thought. It means that if I do something wrong and I can't undo it, well, we need repentance, we need to face it, we need to do something about it. But don't get locked in it, because to get locked in it means I'm still stuck in what I did wrong to my kids or to my wife or husband or church or whoever, you know what I mean? I'm still stuck in that, whereas if I learn from it and did something good now, it's going to go on forever and ever and ever. So what would you choose? Wouldn't it be to get on and do something beautiful? And the beautiful thing goes forever. I think that passage, I don't think I'm reading too much in it, is actually saying that. And there's a beautiful lesson in it. The importance of the first word, which I've just read to you, is indicated by its comparative length and by its position in the code. It's the relationship with which the community has with God that will ultimately determine the relationship with members have with each other. I think one of the questions I was asked earlier says this. If we get God wrong, we're going to get everything wrong. And don't we see plenty of that? If our projected image, thoughts, conceiving of God is awry, it's going to affect everything. So this first commandment which is all going to be, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. We'll do it later in the morning. All these things that you shalt not do. The first thing is, look, get your God right, and everything then will be in a perspective. If we worship the wrong God, we'll fail to respect each other. The words begin with an account of the historical redemption from slavery and oppression in Egypt. The God who is revealing his will to them, the God who is gracing them with the gift of his law, is the same God who heard their cry in Egypt and raised up Moses to liberate them. Now, there, historically, one has to assume, there was a significant escape of slaves from Egypt, from the control of the Egyptians, that started off this whole, it's got to start somewhere, Yahwism didn't come out of nowhere. So it is about an extraordinary religion, about slaves being chosen by God. No other religion had that idea. It's always the boss. So somewhere in lost in the past was an extraordinary event that really was never forgotten and was handed on and stories told about it and so on. But it's about this God who brought us out of slavery, and that's the God we're talking about. We're not commanded to worship an abstract God. It's not a matter of managing to put the right name on any God we may choose to follow. All right, we follow Allah, we follow Yahweh, we follow, and we just put the right name on and everything's fine. What's the name? If you've got the wrong ideas in your head, it's still wrong, isn't it? So when we worship God, inverted commas, we're to worship the one who liberated from slavery in Egypt and no other. That's the one. If we worship the God who hates oppression, we won't be tempted to oppress each other. I'm not picking on them, but I'm just saying, if every Jew in Israel was a saint, a Jewish saint, and there are plenty of Jewish saints, but if the whole community was saintly, they wouldn't be oppressing the Palestinians. How could you? Because they are oppressed people who've been delivered. If every archbishop and bishop and everybody else in the Vatican City was a saint, it'd be really good. If everybody in your parish was a saint, a lot of the discussions you're having wouldn't be bothered with them. It'd be just gorgeous. So can't you see the only thing worth doing is being a saint, which is what God does, of course, but letting it happen. There's nothing else to do. So let God sanctify us, purify us, and we have to challenge religious positions that are coming from fear, the rest of it. So, if we worship a God who hates oppression, and that's what the prophets were trying to get the leaders of their day to do, and the prophets of these days, whatever they are in Israel, the peace people in Israel, are trying to get their government to do it. And no doubt, the saintly prophets among the ordinary people of the West Bank, etc., aren't happy with all this Hamas stuff either. Oh, sorry, not all of it. A lot of it's very good. It's the Vincent de Paul. Hamas are doing more Vincent de Paul work than anybody, probably, in their country. But, you know, the kind of violence. If we make our first and ultimate concern the worship of Yahweh, we'll listen to his word and we'll obey his commands, which we're about to hear about. It's this truth which is at the heart of the 10 words. The ultimate question is not, do you or do you not believe in and worship God? Couldn't care less. I've said it before, may I repeat it? I actually think the second best thing to be in this world is an atheist. That's what I'd be going for. As the second best, I mean. The best is to be a Catholic Christian. A Christian that's open to the universal embrace of the world and God and everything. But rather, who is the God in whom you believe and whom you worship? That's the key question. Someone says they believe in God, that could be really bad or really good, depending on the second part. Who is this God you worship? The 10 words demand that it be Yahweh, the God who hears the cry of the poor. And there's some texts that say that, and the God who took us out of Egypt. The first word warns us against creating our own gods only to be enslaved by them. Graven images is, of course, an obvious example. More subtle are the ways condemned by the prophets. Gods like success, power. These aren't bad things in themselves, but when they're abusing others. Material advancement, independence, pleasure, etc. When the people of Israel asked, who is God, they were able to point to the Exodus, a historical, lost in the mists of history, but a historical, liberating thing that forged their spirituality. We who've come to know Jesus can point to him and to that Catholic, universal, and more complete liberation which he effected by his compassionate love. It was said to you of old, but I say to you. So if we want to know who God is, we look at Jesus. Any idea you've got of God that doesn't fit with Jesus is simply wrong. So you just wipe it out. So if you think women caught in adultery should be stoned, or the equivalent in our cultures, then you've got it wrong. Because Jesus said, I don't condemn you. So we've got to... Just as all their images of God had to be checked against the experience of the Exodus, all our images must be checked against Jesus, his prayer, his faith, his life given in carrying out a mission of love. The God of the Exodus and the God and Father of Jesus cannot be represented in the fixed form of cult images. God cannot be contained even within the inspired words of sacred scripture. They often call it a bibliolatry, worshipping the Bible. And that's not what we're supposed to be doing. Or the infallible expressions of dogma. Some people take as their absolute ground thing, total fidelity to the Pope. Like that's rock solid. Well, for God's sake, go and read about Alexander VI. Go and read about Julius II. Read some history. Find out what some of the popes said. And if you're stupid enough to have it as a rock-solid thing, always do what the Pope said. They don't ever do it, of course. But that's what a stupid rock thing that is. Can't popes be human? Can't popes sin? Can't popes be heretics? Yes. If I was ever Pope... I sincerely hope you wouldn't do everything I said. You'd have enough brains. You could say, I knew him. God. He went to Darlinghurst. Or I knew him. He's a Pole. And he had to fight against communism and Nazism on both sides. And so no wonder he's the way he is. And he's terrific and he's a wonderful man. Or he was in the German Hitler's youth or something. You know what I mean? So... There's God. Nothing is God except God. God remains mysteriously transcendent, and so we must remain always open to the surprise of God's word. Faithful to what he has done in the Exodus, that's the Jewish perspective, and it's beautiful, and Jesus, which dare I say is more beautiful because he enlightens us as to what it's about, and humbly listening and obediently to the word spoken within the community of the faithful, we must always remain ready to journey on into the mystery of divine communion. Given a choice between obedience or lack of obedience, let's choose obedience. I mean, if the bishop gives us instructions about what we're supposed to do in the liturgy, I'm not going to think, oh, well, he's only the bishop and I know better. Do you know what I mean? Where would you get that idea from? So you comply when it's possible. You don't have to win the battles. You win the war, don't you? Just you do what you're told by the... There has to be authority systems. So let's follow them. And sometimes you can't. But you have to have very good reasons not to. And obedience doesn't seem to me to have done anybody any harm, real obedience, I mean, ever. So don't let's put ourselves in the wrong place. We're not allowed to limit our attention to what's obvious. We're not allowed to be content with religious routine. We may not control the divine or make it predictable. We mustn't worship anything less than the real living God. That's the message of the first word. So just following the religious system, which I just talked about a minute ago, if that's what we were doing, that's not what it's about. It's just a matter of humility, obedience, prudence, but always looking for life and so on. And sometimes we have to, well, as a priest, you'd understand this. You've got all these general rules that are there, and they're important. They're in canon law, and you learn them and you know them. But knowing them, you sometimes have to be free to do something a bit different because somebody's dying on the vine, so you give them some water, you know what I mean? You don't say, well, stay there and die with her because it's 2 years and you've got to have all this and you haven't got an annulment yet. And do you know what I mean? We've got to do something better than that. So, and we do, please God. Failure to obey the first word has bad effects on ourselves and others. What we do matters. We can't pretend that it's otherwise. Neither does God pretend. This isn't a place to pursue a careful theological explanation of the theme of divine wrath or punishment, because the first commandment talks about punishment to the fourth generation. Now, we could do that. I've done it elsewhere. I don't want to do it here now. I think it's a projection onto God. And God doesn't punish. We put ourselves in a situation where we suffer the evil effects of our evil actions. The father of the prodigal son didn't punish the boy by sending him to a pig yard. The boy went to a pig yard and suffered the consequences. And his dad was weeping. That's Jesus' image of God. So our image of God has to be the same. We pull down the blinds and it's all dark. But the sun is still shining. So we don't make God change. God is love. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. So our job is to lift the blind for ourselves and for others so that the sun can shine in and it's always there. And it wouldn't be dreadful if I was in a pig yard and someone came along to me and knocked on the gate of the pig yard and said, because of what you did, your father doesn't love you anymore. Now, effectively, that can be what we're told. If we're not careful, we can use God as a whatever controller. But that's sinful. That means if I'm in a pig yard, I won't know where to go. I certainly won't go home because my father is punishing me for what I did. I'm sure you're following me. Yes. But so I can't go into it now. I don't want to. I mean, I do, but I haven't got time. The sacred scriptures make it clear that God doesn't inflict arbitrary evil on those who do not obey him, as though divine punishment were an extra added to the to punish the sinner. Punishment is only the effects brought on by sin itself. God uses it to draw us to repentance. God's involved in the evil effects that we produce, to waken our hearts to think there's got to be something better, so I'll go back to my father's house or whatever. But if we are hard-hearted and obstinate in behaving unjustly, we cannot just wish away the evil results. And God, the truthful one, must declare things to be the way they are. I was hungry and you never gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you never gave me to drink. Fact. Well, and you've hardened your heart against love, so God for all eternity weeps for me as I enjoy my own hell that I've created because I'm too stubborn to admit I'm wrong even in the last mysterious time of dying, like the two thieves on the cross, you know, as symbols of that. If we remain obstinate and refuse to learn from the effects of our sinful behaviour, if we die unrepentant, Jesus himself speaks of the eternal punishment of hell. Jesus spoke about it. So don't let's say, oh, well, God wouldn't be so, God's loving, so he wouldn't have hell. The parents trained their child so wonderfully that the child would never end up in jail. Okay? Well, look at the beautiful parents whose children do end up in jail. I'm not in jail because they haven't caught me. But we could all be there, but for the grace of God go all of us. So, you know, beautiful God doesn't mean we're all going to say yes to it. We're free. This isn't something that God imposes on the sinner, hell. It is, as defined by the Catholic Catechism, number 1033, hell is a state of definitive self-exclusion. There it is. From communion with God and the blessed. Thank God we don't have to believe anyone's in hell. And we're allowed to hope that no one is. And that's quite according to our faith. To hope. But to poo-poo it as though it couldn't be there is very dangerous. If I pluck out my eyes, I'll still be able to see is rather a foolish way of thinking. At the same time as the final words of the first word make clear, divine initiative is always loving. Those who hate God, that is to say, those who do not allow God's creating and redeeming love to be effective in their lives, will end up destroying themselves and hurting others. However, those who love God, that is to say, those who say yes to God's will and open themselves to God's grace and blessing, will experience life, and their influence will go on forever. You and I are still benefiting from the prayers of our great, 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 great grandmothers and fathers who knelt down somewhere and prayed for us. We're still benefiting from it. And people are still benefiting from any bit of loving any of us have ever done is making the world as good as it is. So that's the first word. And I suppose I've done it a bit quickly, but that's the point of it. I'll go back perhaps and look at it again with you. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It's all about liberation. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make any of yourself for yourself an idol, brackets, as they were doing in Babylon and every other place they saw, whether in the form of anything in heaven or on earth or in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. And it's possible to translate worship them there, be enslaved by them. For I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me, equals keep my commandments. The second word, Exodus chapter 20, just one verse. It's an amazing commandment, and it's broken all the time, but if you just thought to yourself, I don't know when you last went to confession, I reckon, see, I try and go once a month, and sometimes I forget, and I go along to dear old Father Drinkwater and say, my God, it's about 4 months. So we swap stoles and clean each other up, and then off we go again. So it's good to do it, you know. We used to do it every week when I was young, and you had to be thinking what to say and making things up. You just can't go in there and have nothing to say. So I fought with my little sister. Yeah, I've given you my regular confession. And it was true, too, I did. My God, she fought with me. And she was a bit cleverer than me, too. My worst belting I ever got Dad used to lose his block every now and then because we had one girl and then six boys, and then a girl. Imagine six boys marauding around the family. Dad had a weak heart. He died of 60 of an asthmatic heart. So he didn't have good health, and he had to do all the wage earning, and Mum looked after all that. So one time I'm in there, we just finished the rosary. We all had to say the rosary. And my little sister, I don't know what I am, I'm 9 and she's 7 or something like that, or I might have been 10 and she's 8 or something. We're just primary thing. She got up and pushed me into a lounge chair. Well, what are we? I mean, John Wayne, eat your heart out. So I got up and pushed her into a lounge chair. Nothing more than that. Oh, my God, all hell broke loose. And Dad came out, and I couldn't reach the bolt. I was still little at the top of the back door to get out. And he hit me with a broom, and I had a bleeding nose, and Mum was there frantic trying to keep Dad away from me, and then she was belting Margaret to make it look. And I just remember this total chaos, and then I'm later on in the bath with a bleeding nose, somebody washing it and trying to fix it all up. Why did I tell you that? Why did I tell you that? Oh, yeah, about confession. I still don't know why I told it to you. Anyhow, fighting with my little sister, yeah. Here's the second commandment. You shall not make... Really watch this, because I would suspect if I had time after and you all wanted to come along to me confession and you didn't mention the second commandment, I'd say, hello, your examination of conscience is a bit slack. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of Yahweh your God, for Yahweh will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Before I give you the second, I grew up thinking that was swearing. Like if you said Jesus it's just as a swear word, well, I could tell that in confession. Or if you said God, well, that's not very good to use God's name. So that, you know what I mean? We called that swearing, I think. And bugger seemed to come in there somewhere too, so I don't know how, and bloody, and that's all the ones I knew. We weren't allowed to use any of those words in our home. So we used them reasonably regularly, but got a belting for it when we did. That's not about this. This is using, and I'll take you through it, and you just examine your conscience if you wouldn't mind. The second word goes much further than ensuring we refer to God in a reverent way or a polite way. It applies to everything we do in God's name. The person who claims to be speaking for God, but whose words do not come from God, is breaking this commandment, this second word. If I get up in the pulpit and said, God says, and hit you with something that God doesn't say, if I use God to support my point of view or my best thoughts, do you see what's happening? I'm using God's name in vain. I'm using God to support what I'm saying. People are doing it all the time, for God's sake. For God's sake. I don't know, is that breaking the second commandment? Oh, I better shut up. I think I'll be into it. But we're doing it, it's happening all the time. It's happening in churches all over the world. It's happening from imams and cardinals and, all over the place. God being used to support. And sometimes from when you're sitting there listening to a homily, if it's not clear when the priest, for example, is actually sharing with you material that's at the centre of our faith, that's a matter of faith, that's important. Or what about when he's sharing with you just his best thoughts about something, which is a good thing to do too, I presume. Don't you think he should let you know the difference? So that he's not supporting God, what the priest says, God says, what the Pope says, God says. Well, hang on, might be. Let's check it. So I'll come back to my comment here. So it's not about just, it's applying to everything we do in God's name. The person who claims to be speaking for God but whose words don't come from God is breaking this command. Think of all the images of God that you have because God was used for you as a child to support a moralistic point of view or whatever it might be. And so you've projected those images onto God, but you shouldn't have. It was your dad or your mum or the priest or the church, or your Presbyterian background who said, God said you can't dance, What do you do with that when there's a girl there looking pretty nice and you feel like dad's sick? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the Catholic Church is good in the sense that it seems to let you do everything. Drink, drugs, smoke, dance. There's a few things we weren't allowed to do, but anyhow, jokes aside. The person who claims but his word is breaking the person or institution that in God's name behaves in ways that are not consistent with the action of God in the Exodus or in Jesus is breaking this second word. Using God's name in vain. Anyone who would attempt, however subtly, to confine God within the limits of human words or customs is breaking God's word. Anyone, a fundamentalist, they'd hate to know it, but a person who takes every word literally in the Bible and imposes it on people as written is using God to support an unintelligent point of view. They're using God's name. They're breaking the second commandment. So I think this is actually broken quite a bit. When we reflect on all the injustices that have been done in God's name, all the imperfect images of God that have been imposed on people in God's name, we begin to realise how radical this second word is. We must be very careful when we call on God to support our teaching. Prophecy, theology, liturgy and prayer can be genuine or they can be false. They can be authentic expressions of genuine religious encounters with the living God, or they can be substitutes for such an encounter. Religions are full of shattering of the second commandment. Instead of pointing us towards the God of the Exodus, any unliberating thing, and I mean liberating from within as without, anything that's unliberating of the person and conforms them and confines them, that's got nothing to do with God. The God of the Exodus was not about conforming, confining, clipping wings. It was about flight, wasn't it? It was about freedom. It was about movement. It was about a promised land, not getting locked into slavery. Jesus was certainly not about unliberating behaviour and keeping everybody on a safe path, treading the middle line all the way. He didn't, and he didn't let anyone else do it either. So a lot of the apostles seem to have ended up saints. He did something to encourage people to dare to find who they are and live it to the full. I've come, he said, that you may live and live to the full. So everything we get from the Bible, the basic insights of Israel and the basic insights of Christianity are all about liberation. And of course, one of the key things, then we need all the wisdom, all your wisdom, all my parents' wisdom, all the wisdom of the catechism, all the wisdom of the councils of the church to help us realise that some of the things we want to do are coming. Freedom is a pretty difficult thing, isn't it? So liberation, if I thought liberation was doing what I feel like and not having people stop me, I'd be a very unliberated person, wouldn't I? I'd be absolutely trapped by my own unthought-out desires. So liberation is a demanding thing, but it's what the goal is. So to conclude, the second word demands the utmost care when we speak or act in God's name.